The Log, A Dwarf's Guide to Everything, by Craig Charles and Russell Bell. Read by Craig Charles. A definitive chronicle of the human race, comprising a retrospective and comparative look at mankind's triumphs and follies throughout the ages. Honest. Introduction. Episodes of Red Dwarf tend to focus on the more exciting and noteworthy events in the life of the crew. However, it's not all thrills and spills for the characters or the actors. Many hours are spent slumped around the set while the crew strive to mend the carefully crafted props that, for some reason, seem to fall apart in my hands as soon as the director says action. During these periods of relative calm, I sometimes wonder what my character would do in the quiet, untroubled times between adventures. Lister would probably spend many hours alone in his bunk pondering the ramifications of being the only surviving example of Homo sapiens in the universe. Personally, I tend to pass the time on set arguing with Danny about music or winding Robert up about how middle class he is. But what if I really were the last remaining human? How would I fill that endless chasm between sleep and curry, knowing that I was the last example of and final spokesman for an occasionally great race? I'd like to think the last human would spend his time compiling a comparative list of scientific and sociological milestones in the development of the human race. An attempt, if you will, to leave something for posterity. Something that says, when I'm gone, the human race will be no more, but my people were once noble and clever, and look, we even invented the whoopee cushion. Of course, Dave Lister isn't the first name that springs to mind as the ideal chronicler of the human race, and neither is Craig Charles. However, if you're the last human being in the universe, it's a little hard to delegate. But, I hear you cry, surely Dave Lister is merely a character in a TV series. Yes. But in an infinite universe, if something can exist, then it must exist. Therefore, Dave is out there somewhere. And I'd like to think a little bit of me is with him. Hopefully not the bit he keeps in his underpants. Nostradamus made numerous predictions about the future. He foretold the death of kings, the coming of comets, and even the arrival of an individual named Hister. Sound familiar? Who would have a marked effect on human history. Not unlike Nostradamus, I have taken the liberty of predicting certain developments in man's future. To do this, I've utilised a literary trick known, in the trade, as making it up. If you just bought this book at an antiquarian book fair at Beetlejuice, and you notice that some of my predictions are a tad off the mark, well, that's just tough. I'll have been dead for 200 years, so what you think is the least of my problems. If, however, you bought this recording new, thank you. I'll always love you. Allow me to reassure you that everything recorded here has been carefully researched, cross-referenced, annotated, then thrown away and made up from scratch while at least partially drunk, which is probably the best state to be in when you listen to it. If the last remaining human being in the universe left behind a chronicle of any kind, I suspect it wouldn't be entirely dissimilar to that which I'm about to read to you. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you The Log. Part 1. The Development of the Human Race. In a break from tradition, the first part of this log is exceptionally long. I feel this is justified given its subject matter, which is, in fact, everything. But, being a pedantic git, you might say, if the first chapter deals with everything, what on earth is the rest of the chronicle about? I would have thought that was obvious. Everything else, of course. The later part of this log consists of thoughts, recipes, personal observations, and little collections of accumulated wisdom garnered over many years of enthusiastic wisdom garnering. If I were the last remaining human, I would include these sections in my log because they say you should write about what you know, and frankly, I don't know anything else. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed one afternoon last summer with two synchronized swimmers and a bucket of strawberry mousse. Mathematics. Primitive man developed a simple system of counting that consisted of one, two, many. As tribal communities evolved, this system became inefficient. If a scout returned with news of many enemies coming over the hill, the chief didn't know if he meant three guys with a catapult or 24,000 nutcases armed with big sticks. This led to a more sophisticated system of counting that introduced the concept of shitloads. This word became a cue to run away very fast and hide in a bush. Counting became important in other aspects of life in the ancient world. Kings would be frustrated at not knowing how many wives they had. They might know they had shitloads, but if they didn't know exactly how many, how could they keep track of them all the time? Thus were accountants born. Later on in man's evolution, mathematics was developed into an exact science by such luminaries as Aristotle, Euclid, Newton, Napier, and Einstein. However, In the latter half of the 20th century, politicians invented a branch of statistics called bollocks, a mathematical method enabling them to prove that anything equaled anything else given adequate funding. This put mathematics back 48,000 years. The binary system was one of the most important developments of the 20th century. This stroke of mathematical genius allowed the world to be defined in terms of one or nothing. A counting system that was infinitely less sophisticated than one, two, many of our prehistoric ancestors. The binary system was developed because, although computers can count really, really fast, they're so stupid they can only count as far as one before they get hopelessly confused and add six noughts to your gas bill. Chaos mathematics came to the fore towards the end of the second millennia and was something to do with butterfly wings and water drips. But the academic drips that came up with it finally admitted that there was no room in maths for damp Lepidoptera and began work on something more useful. In the middle of the 20th century, mathematics finally reached its nadir when some bright spark called Patek Ramflam Pamjam Ram invented a numbering system consisting entirely of zeros. Thereafter, if you asked the computer what it was thinking about, the response was invariably, "Oh, nothing." Medicine. In Neolithic times, hunter-gatherers would go forth into the unknown with wooden clubs, or pointed sticks if they were particularly intellectual, and bring back food for their mates and offspring. However, around this time, a new kind of human also evolved, one that had seen all too clearly what can happen if you confront a hungry saber-toothed tiger with nothing but a pointy stick and a big mouth. An individual who witnessed a bleeding hunter being dragged back to the cave with a broken stick and a hopelessly overblown story about how he'd almost had that bastard before he got his leg bitten off. This individual rushed forward and with a voice laden with authority and conviction bellowed, "Let me through! I've got some bones and a rattle!" Thus was modern medicine born. Early ailments such as headaches, rheumatism and sprained ankles were treated by drilling a hole in the head to let the devils out. This didn't cure anything, but people tended to complain less about their health, which helped to relieve the burden on the overworked health service. Later on, shamans came to realise that plants could be used to cure certain ailments, and they would feed their gullible patients all sorts of rubbishy old roots and weeds until something worked. The ones that didn't die were pronounced cured. Thus was the pharmaceutical industry born, and lard was touted as the ultimate food supplement to ensure a long and happy life. Later, Alexander Fleming hit upon the inspired idea of feeding sick people mouldy bread to see what happened. Amazingly, it cured them. It just goes to show, you never know when a weird idea might work. Over the ages, medicine gradually developed into a thriving science. The shaman's son would take over the family business, as in later years, Harley Tree specialists would hand over practices to their equally greedy and pompous offspring. This time-honoured tradition ensured that there would always be someone around who could convince you you'd die without a 10 grand appendix transplant. The late 20th century saw the beginnings of genetic engineering as a tool for doing all sorts of weird stuff. This was immediately banned, and research in this field ceased everywhere, apart from those laboratories that had a lock on the door. Vitamins were touted as the ultimate supplement to ensure a long and happy life. In 2036, a pharmaceutical drug called Neoprozac was made compulsory for everyone on the planet, so they didn't get depressed about the ozone layer and afternoon TV scheduling. Rebel enclaves who refused to take it sprung up around the world, and they would hide in caves and be miserable, and occasionally hit each other on the head with sticks. Cloning became a popular trend in 2055. Rich people would have a clone of themselves made, so they would always have a ready supply of compatible organs when theirs gave out. The clones weren't exactly overjoyed with this concept, and in 2060, they formed a union to defend their rights. Sadly, a test case in Arkansas, presided over by a number of rich judges with clones of their own, determined that the clones were the property of the original DNA donors. This led to the clone riots of 2061, in which a number of people ended up beating themselves to death. 2217 saw the invention of an antibiotic so powerful that you had to be in perfect health to take it. Later, a neo-drug called Infinitol was touted as the key to immortality. It was guaranteed to completely halt the aging process, a promise it fulfilled to a limited extent, in that it invariably killed anyone stupid enough to swallow one. Fashion. Clothes were initially invented during the Ice Age, when one bright spark theorized that instead of throwing animal skins away because you couldn't eat them, you could wrap yourself up in them and not be so bloody freezing. From that moment on, fashion was invented. Certain skins became de rigueur, and anyone seen wearing last season's mammoth hide was humiliated with taunts and left out on the ice to perish until they got stylish or dead, whichever came first. Hemlines rose and fell with the seasons, and accessories such as bones and the ears of enemies became the in thing. Leather remained the fabric of choice for about 40,000 years, until a very confused person came up with the concept of weaving, and the fashion garment industry really took off. Via a judicious study of worms' bottoms, silk was discovered in the Far East, and suddenly women around the globe knew exactly what they wanted for their birthdays. Thus haute couture was born, and from Peking to Timbuktu, men became poor overnight. The concept of power dressing was instigated in Japan by the samurai, whose finely crafted garb invariably included a 3-foot razor-sharp head remover. I mean, that's power in anyone's language. Throughout the Orient, style and quality reigned. Status was defined by the intricately woven garments worn by the rich and powerful. In Rome and Athens, flowing togas and ornate armour were very much the thing. In Britain, guys painted themselves blue and shouted a lot, thus preempting Chelsea supporters by a couple of millennia. Towards the end of the 20th century, female fashion was largely defined by skirt length. By the year 2000, skirts had become so short that they were worn round the neck like chokers and offered little or no protection against the elements. But men were very happy, except during the period when fashion required them to wear paisley nappies. Sadly, whichever way they looked at this garment, they failed to convince themselves that they looked good. But at least they were fashionable, and at the end of the day, that's all that mattered. Possibly the greatest fashion breakthrough occurred in 2198 with the invention of soft clothes. Computer-generated clothes that were projected around the body from a digital necklace. Thermal insulation was provided by a variable kinetic force field that agitated air molecules adjacent to the body to provide heat. The opacity of the virtual garment could be controlled by a small handheld unit, and much fun was had by teenagers who managed to hack the code for a girl's garment and render it transparent while she was bending over. Girls had equal fun by making guys' clothing transparent while they were looking at the girl bending over, and many a beau was seen scurrying for the shadows with his tail between his legs. For 6 months in 2210, fashion dictated that clothes should be abandoned altogether in favour of a genetically induced hairy fleece that could be grown to order around the body. This fashion died out quite rapidly when everyone realised that it looked completely gross, although it retained a certain popularity in Greece and Italy, where no one noticed the difference. Historical footnote. The only recorded instance of a major conflict caused by differing views on fashion were the tie wars of the 22nd century. The workers of the world rebelled against the tie-wearing classes, and a bloody conflict ensued. The blue-collar, blisters, and the management, ties, fought tooth and nail until the ties introduced a devastating weapon. The smart but casual bomb, which would shower the enemy with paisley cravats and hand-tailored lounge suits. The blisters were about to admit defeat when they suddenly realised that it was they who were manufacturing all the weapons for the ties, so they stopped. This proved the most decisive strike of the war, and the whole thing ended in compromise. The blisters agreed to do up the top button of the shirts as a concession towards smartness, while the ties retained their ties, but wore them with the top buttons undone as a gesture of solidarity with the workers. Religion. Since the dawn of time, man has had a need to worship a higher power. The sun was an early favourite, as were trees, and the odd big-mouthed git who managed to get together a few followers by advocating virgin sacrifices, naked orgies, and other prehistoric crowd-pleasers. At this point, I must confess that I'm probably not qualified to provide an in-depth comparative analysis of world religions, mainly because I don't know smeg about them. However, I know a lot about smeg, so here is my summary of the world's religions in terms of smeg. Taoism. Smeg happens. Hare Krishna. Smeg happens, Rama Rama Ding Dong. Zen. What is the sound of smeg clapping? Islam. If Smeg happens, take a hostage. Buddhism. When Smeg happens, is it really Smeg? Judaism. Why does Smeg always happen to me? Protestantism. Smeg won't happen if I work harder. Catholicism. If Smeg happens, I deserve it. Hinduism. This Smeg has happened before. Jehovah's Witnesses. Knock, knock. Smeg happens. Baptists. If you go right under, all that Smeg will wash off. Unitarian. What's all this Smeg about? Seventh-day Adventist. Smeg happens on Saturdays. Confucianism. Confucius. He says Smeg happens. Mormon. Smeg happens over and over again. Scientology. The machine says you're full of Smeg. New Age. Smeg comes in spaceships. Let us around this Smeg in white light and heal it. Rosicrucians. There's a lot of secret Smeg you know nothing about. Rastafarianism. Hey, man. Let's smoke some of this Smeg. Well, there you have it. If there are any present-day religions I have failed to include, I'm sorry. I'm not infallible. Also, if I have offended anyone, please forgive me, for I know not what I do. As with anything in the sphere of human development, religions are constantly evolving and changing. However, all the world's religions were forced to have a bit of a rethink when God turned up in New York on December 25th, 2235, and announced his displeasure at the fact that no one had even sent him a card, let alone bought him a present. Then, when he saw the state his creation was in, he totally lost it and went off in a divine huff, saying he never wanted to speak to us again. And to be fair, you can't really blame him. Music. Early music relied heavily on percussion, usually produced by the impact of a club on someone's skull. This was later refined to the art of banging two rocks together while shouting. Thus were rock music and bad jokes born. Wind instruments had their genesis when a particularly inventive Cro-Magnon blew into a bone and a whole load of slimy shit flew out with a sort of farting sound. Hey presto! Modern jazz was created. Throughout the world, witch doctors and shamans discovered the benefits of shouting in tune and decided to call it singing. Someone made a list of different sounding shoutings and called them notes. This eventually led to people like Mozart using loads of them in quick succession to create symphonies and royalties. The art of music became more and more refined over the centuries until it finally reached its pinnacle when Mike Batt recorded Remember You're a Womble. Music is largely defined by the instruments of a given era. During the 21st century, classical instruments such as the violin and trombone lapsed in popularity, largely because they were so bloody hard to play. Synthesizers, controlled by AI computers, came to the fore. These instruments could play any sound imaginable, as well as writing songs and lyrics and singing along to them. All the musician had to do was turn them on, and a number of virtuoso performers gained prominence due to their deftness with the on switch. One of the most stunning events in musical history occurred in 2167, when one of the artificial intelligence synthesizers, totally independently, came up with a perfect version of Remember You're a Womble, to universal acclaim. Fun things to do in your car. Paint the words Help Me in blood-red paint with your hand on the back window of your car and see how far you can drive without being stopped by the police. Or drive around and put every stray cat you see on the back seat of your car. After about five, things should get interesting. Or stop and pray to roadkill. Or forget to wind down the window during a drive-by shooting. Or connect your brake lights to your horn so that every time you brake, you hoot the car in front. Or enter a stock car race and insist on towing a caravan round the track. For added fun, your bank manager should be in the caravan. Or employ a life-size model of Tyrannosaurus Rex as a hood ornament. Or fill your car with helium, stop regularly, and ask directions. Or play a tape of a human heartbeat very loudly when you stop at the traffic lights. Stare at the driver next to you with a manic, wide-eyed expression. Or put a bumper sticker with tiny writing on the back of your car so that people keep crashing into you as they try to read it. The bumper sticker should read, Please keep your distance. Or Another jolly bumper sticker is Keep Honking.
I'm reloading. It is only available at Jehovah's Witnesses Kingdom Halls.
Oh, test your driving skills by trying to parallel park in a small space between two Ferraris with your eyes closed. And lastly, if you get stopped by a police officer, keep looking at your watch. Then say, how long is this going to take? Because your missus is expecting me. Weapons. Teeth were probably the first effective weapon ever used by man. But anyone suggesting the tongue was the first effective weapon ever used by woman is far braver than me. Other body parts were no doubt utilised as we became more sophisticated. For example, the index finger could be used to inflict ridicule on an enemy by pointing it at his big hairy enemy feet and going... The concept of the bow and arrow appeared very early on in man's history, albeit with limited success. It took the invention of string to convert it into the deadly weapon it was to become. Far later, the neutron bomb was hailed as a tactical innovation in that it was able to kill everyone within a mile radius whilst leaving all the buildings undamaged. It was presumably designed by a fan of architecture with no mates. Weapon design reached its nadir with the proton cannon of Nakasami, the most powerful weapon ever developed. The prototype was mounted on an early starship and tested at the outer reaches of the solar system. Coincidentally, according to government sources, on the same day that Pluto disappeared. Unfortunately, the recoil from the weapon was so great that it propelled the starship back through the solar system, where it became embedded in Titan, a moon of Jupiter. It developed into a popular tourist attraction and was the first weapon in history to recoup its development costs through tourism. Female erogenous zones. Female erogenous zones weren't discovered, at least not by men, until 1240, when guys immediately invented the chastity belt out of jealousy. During the 20th century, a magazine called Cosmopolitan got bored with the clitoris and sent out an expedition to find something more exciting. The expedition returned with news of a fabulous new erogenous zone called the G-spot, which was incredibly hard to find, but apparently well worth the effort, especially if you were the person it was on. In the year 2354, whilst trying to scratch a particularly elusive itch, a Miss Sky bottle from Titan discovered the Z-spot. This tiny but highly sensitive area is supposed to be the source of the ultimate fountain of female ecstasy, according to the renamed Cosmopolitan. However, it is situated so far up the vagina that you have to dislodge a kidney to get at it, and even if you do find it, no one's yet worked out what to do with it. Politics. Back in prehistory, leadership was established via an ability to hit opponents over the head with a bone. This form of meritocratic government was simple, efficient, and hard to argue with unless you wanted a seriously bad headache. Eventually, the stick was discovered, which in turn led to the invention of the club, and the arms race was on. Things were fine for millennia until Democritus had the bright idea that everyone should get involved in the running of things, and it all went pants. By the late 20th century, politics had degenerated into a promisocracy, whereby the politician who made the most ludicrously optimistic promises was voted into power, and thereafter hated by everyone for his or her complete inability to deliver the heaven on earth he or she had promised. Politicians developed their own language, with which to communicate their glorious visions of a country under their inspired and altruistic leadership. This language came to be known as bollocks, and was also widely used by people in the media and estate agents. By 2190, a world government had been established and all major decisions were put to a worldwide vote via the Ultranet, a system whereby a central computer collated the input from each citizen's personal computer implant and relayed the result to anyone that cared. This system collapsed when the main Ultra computer broke, and thereafter, leadership was determined by a candidate's ability to hit his opponents on the head with a big stick. This breakthrough proved to be a major leap forward and led to mankind's conquest of space, which in itself wasn't difficult as it largely consisted of nothing. After the invention of the continuum drive, open brackets TM close brackets, colonies were established on outlying planets, led by pioneering individuals with big sticks. Many of these colonies perished due to a lack of anything worth breathing in the atmosphere, but a number thrived and led to the creation of the Federation of Planets, an intergalactic governmental body presided over by a bunch of huge bastards with massive sticks. For 1,000 years, peace reigned throughout the galaxies, until one day, when a couple of the leaders started making ridiculous promises, and the whole thing turned to doggy-doo.
Art. Mankind's first attempts at art were crude handprints on cave walls that said, "Look, I've got a hand." Probably followed by a little kid going, "Mum's going to kill you for painting all over the cave wall." Early cave art was not exactly sophisticated, but nevertheless quite an artistic coup for a Cro-Magnon with the intellect of celery. Later on, hunters would paint pictures of buffalo, antelope, and guys in spacesuits on the cave wall just to freak out archaeologists. The 20th century was a turning point for art. Not because anything particularly great was produced, but because a whole pile of stuff suddenly became seriously valuable. Old paintings by artists who had died of starvation were suddenly deemed to be worth more than the gross national product of most countries. This situation was created by gallery owners who managed to convince the wealthier members of the population that a rectangle of canvas with a certain amount of paint on was worth more than most people could earn in 20 lifetimes, with no days off. The skill of the painters was never in doubt, and the emotional impact of the works in question was unarguable. But the whole system of attaching ludicrous prices to artwork produced by dead artists because of their rarity was called into question when Vincent van Gogh was cloned from the remains of his ear in 2156 and failed to produce anything worth looking at because he hadn't been shouted at by his father when he was 4. As a matter of interest, van Gogh painted 372 pictures. Americans own 643 of these. Science fiction. Early science fiction evolved around the prehistoric campfire. The young would marvel at the tales of a devastating, futuristic weapon that could hurl death over great distances. Yes, a deftly flung rock was indeed an awesome harbinger of destruction. Science fiction has always postulated the existence of technological gadgets that the reader can imagine existing in the near future. The anti-gravity belt was easy to imagine in the 20th century, and many were built at the time. Sadly, they lacked the little black box that provided the anti-gravity field, and hence it was hard to differentiate them from the more mundane belts that defied gravity merely by holding up your trousers. However, in spite of its shortcomings, this literary form has always been at the forefront of innovation. Arthur C. Clarke wrote a short science fiction story and accidentally invented the communications satellite. I wrote a short science fiction story and accidentally invented bad science fiction. What the hell? We can't all be geniuses. Sci-fi is a wonderful means of escaping from a world where an insane mugger can shoot you in a side street to a world where an insane alien can shoot you in a side street on a different planet. Basically, the future is just now, only with better gadgets. Obviously, science fiction via Red Dwarf has played a major part in my life. The only downside is that people seem to expect me to be a mine of knowledge regarding all things scientific. Let's get this straight once and for all. I wasn't cast as a curry-guzzling slob with an affinity for lager because of my qualifications in astrophysics, okay? Arrest me case. However, I do have an interest in science simply because some of the theories are so bizarre. Take continuum space. The normal 3D space we live in has three axes at right angles to each other. Continuum space has an infinite number of axes, all at right angles to each other. I have a theory that continuum space is a place that only physicists visit, and only when they're very drunk. Have you ever seen one of those films where an evil scientist has devised a fiendish plan to take over the world? The good guys break into his laboratory to steal the plans and are confronted by racks of equipment with flashing lights and row upon row of alphabetical filing cabinets. Then they spend hours searching every nook and cranny for the relevant document until they're caught and tortured with death rays and tin hats with wires on. Guys, here's a piece of advice. Go straight to the filing cabinet marked X. Never in the history of science fiction has any mad scientist ever called his master plan Project W. Despite some of its cliched shortcomings, I must confess that I love science fiction. I was brought up on it. Milk might have been better, but times were hard. Good sci-fi opens doors to undreamed-of galaxies and teaches the young to use their imaginations. Unfortunately, it also teaches them to pester you night and day for a Buzz Lightyear action figure. Whatever. Here's to science fiction. May it live long and prosper. Dancing. One of the few art forms that has endured throughout mankind's evolution is dance. Prehistoric man was inspired by the elaborate mating rituals of animals and attempted to emulate them by waving his arms and legs about like a windmill and thinking he looked cool. Throughout history, men have attempted to impress women by dancing at them. For millennia, the human male has tried to impress a total stranger of the opposite sex by waving his arms around and grinning like a moron. This is possibly the saddest aspect of the human race. No human female has ever selected a mate on the basis of his ability to wave his arms around and move his feet in complex but unnatural patterns. Towards the end of the second millennia, dance was refined into a complex and sophisticated art form known as ballet, which involved highly trained young women in very short skirts, opening their legs as far as possible, while men jumped around the stage with huge bulges in their tights. This made some sense vis-a-vis the human mating ritual, but the ticket prices for these shows were far and above those charged in places like Holland and Bangkok, where the performers would cut the crap and just shag each other without all the jumping around in silly outfits. Throughout history, dancers remained pretty constant, consisting, as it always has, of people waving their arms and legs in more or less embarrassing and athletic ways until someone either claps or bursts out laughing. So, it will always be. At this point, and against my better judgment, I'm going to share an embarrassing little story with you. The story of how Fred Astaire ruined my favourite jacket. It really was all Fred Astaire's fault. There I sat, innocently flicking through the channels, looking for intellectual stimulation. Well, I'm not going to admit to Baywatch, am I? When I hit silk stockings, there was Fred, signally failing to woo the object of his desires. Then he has a bright idea. He dances at her. She goes all soppy and melts into his arms. End of story. It was then that I heard it. At the back of the cerebellum, just above the medulla oblongata, is a little-known area of the brain called the goon. Normally, it lies dormant, but occasionally it awakens and comes up with a monumentally stupid idea. Usually something along the lines, I bet I could do that. Now, anyone with an iota of sense knows to disregard the goon at all costs. For God's sake, the last time I listened to it, I ended up in a charity boxing match with a professional who kept forgetting about the little orphans in Bosnia and was clearly convinced that for some reason he was fighting a Liverpudlian comedian for the world championship. There's no way I'm falling for that one again, I told myself as I watched my hand reach for the yellow pages and turn to the section on dance. Please don't let this be happening, said the pathetically inadequate section of my brain that handles common sense. But it was all too late. The goon saturated my mind's eye with visions of yours truly in the centre of a dance floor, in a tuxedo, burning lust-crazed supermodels off my body with a cigarette butt. It was all over by the ambulance. The finger dialed. A lady answered. Have you had any previous experience of dancing? Inquired the plummy voice at the end of the line. Well, nothing professional, I intoned, in a manner calculated to convey that the Bally Rombeau were constantly on the phone, trying to coax me into accepting the principal role in their forthcoming production of The Man with the Magic Feet. The goon has a friend in the ego department. To cut a long story short, I enrolled for a private beginner's course in tap dancing with someone called Horatio. I know now it was at this point that I should have called the Samaritans. I entered the Academy of Dance with a shoddy sports bag and a fixed grin. The receptionist glared at me as if she expected me to try and sell her a plastic dog turd. Horatio, tap midday, I said, trying to sound professional. She stared expectantly, as if waiting for the punchline of an obscure joke. Surely I couldn't be serious. Finally, her eyebrows returned to their normal station, and her wry grin subsided, indicating that she now realised I was serious. I was eventually given directions to Studio 4 on the first floor. On the way, I passed hordes of lithe young things who squeaked with fitness and hopefully fell for my
It's okay. I'm only here to read the meter walk. I could almost hear the deflating balloon noise my confidence made as it leaked from my body and ran screaming for the hills. I finally arrived and surveyed the door to Studio 4. I was so nervous, even my hair was clenched. The goon hit an override switch somewhere and pushed me through the door. Horatio was doing the splits against the wall. I had secretly been hoping that he'd be about 55, with a bit of a paunch, so that I'd have at least half a chance of keeping up. There before me stood 6 feet of whipcord muscle gleaming in the midday sun. He was obviously fresh from an overdose of handsome pills. Mr. Charles. 11,000 brilliant excuses flashed into my head, where they were carefully filtered, edited, and finally distilled into my answer. Yes. Then we chatted about this and that, until he hit me with the big question. So why do you want to learn tap dancing? So that I can tap dance, was all I could come up with at short notice in the witty and erudite stakes. Remember, I was nervous. What style of tap would you like to learn? Style? You mean there are different styles? This was getting worse. Suddenly, Horatio's feet blared into an accurate impersonation of a food mixer on overdrive. A tattoo like a Jamaican machine gun with a backbeat echoed around the studio. Then he switched off gravity and did something very bizarre that looked like a gyroscope with arms. I was now seriously excited. That's it, I cried. I want to do that. I think we'd better start with a few basics. We'll just do a little warm-up first. 15 minutes later, I was a broken, wheezing wreck. Every fibre of my being begging for intensive care or the blessed relief of death. I glanced frantically around, trying to discover what fiendish device had removed all the air from the room. Okay, let's dance. My God, he's not only handsome, but he has a fine sense of humour to boot. However, a Charles never throws in the towel, which is probably why there are so few of us. I danced. This is the basic shuffle and kick. He flexed like the original tiger on Vaseline. Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat-tat. I stuck my tongue out of the corner of my mouth to indicate concentration and lurched into a spastic travesty of his liquid footwork. Flubbity-flubbity-squeak, flabbity-squeal. Those Nike trainers aren't exactly the ideal footwear for tap. My God, a master of dance and understatement. The lesson continued. I began to make progress. Well, at least my heart was tap dancing. Horatio gave me the address of a theatrical footwear shop in Soho. I dropped by on my way home and inquired about tap shoes. And who are they for? Asked the anorexic ex-dancer behind the counter, looking down her balletic nose. Once we had cleared up the misunderstanding, she waddled off with her feet at 3:15 and her bun held high. She returned with my tap shoes. They cost more than my last car. I decided to wear them home to break them in. Halfway through Berwick Street Market, I made the fatal error of stepping on a manhole cover. The taps on my shoes became frictionless. I hovered horizontally in the air for what seemed like ages, but can't have been more than 5 minutes. Arms pinwheeling pathetically with that distinct lack of grace peculiar to non-dancers, and landed in an abandoned box of overripe avocados. The torn elbow and slime stains on my favourite Catherine Hamnett jacket proclaimed it a non-survivor. I never returned to the academy. I removed the taps from my shoes and now wear them only for the gardening I never do. Fred Astaire ruined my favourite jacket. Things you don't want to hear on regaining consciousness after an operation. I'm sorry, but we were only able to thaw your head. Are you sure this was the guy that wanted the sex change operation? I don't know what it is either. Stick it in ice and we'll put it back later.
Shut up. If he doesn't know, he can't sue.
Danger. I have a pretty far-reaching theory that I'd like to share with you at this point. There is nothing in your immediate vicinity that could not kill you. Oh, yeah, I hear you scoff, but I can prove it. Look around you. Can you see anything life-threatening? No? In that case, you're not looking properly. That supermarket receipt on the table. It could blow into the electric fire, set fire to the carpet, and burn you to death while you snooze. A prawn or a slice of courgette can choke you to death. You could fall over and smash your skull on any hard object. Your beloved cat, dog, or marmoset could trip you down the stairs, leaving you in a mangled but still warm heap that it could then go to sleep on. Heavy furniture could crush you. Lights could plummet from the ceiling and mash your brain to a strawberry pulp. A tiny fly could enter your ear and drive you suicidally insane with its endless buzzing. Anything electric can electrocute you. Anything gas can gas you. Anything hanging can hang you. And presumably anything wicker can wick you. Which isn't a pleasant concept. It's a miracle any of us survive at all. The only major predators we have in this country are tax inspectors and motorists. But there is still danger everywhere, and we ignore it. We have to. If we didn't, we'd all go insane with paranoia. It's a fact that the vast majority of accidents occur in the home. So maybe the best thing you can do is move. It's not surprising that homes are so dangerous, though. The kitchen's full of razor-sharp knives, gas ovens, microwave generators, blenders, mincers, grinders and graters. The lounge bristles with high-voltage equipment such as TVs, hi-fis and lava lamps. In the garden, the lawnmower waits patiently for the moment it can remove your feet with revolving knives. The bath sits with baited bubbles in anticipation of the moment you slip up, bash your head on the sink, and die with a tap rammed up your nose. The chemicals we casually fling down the toilet skulk in cupboards in expectation of the moment we finally get the formula right and blow the toilet through the roof. Somewhere in the roof cavity lurks a huge brass bomb full of boiling water under pressure. That sounds safe now, doesn't it? Why are you still reading this? Why haven't you dropped the book and run screaming into the street? It's not a jungle out there. Jungles are safe compared to the average home. Take a member of a recently discovered Stone Age tribe out of his jungle, stick him in a modern flat, and he'd be dead, mutilated and partially cooked in 40 seconds. The last sound he would hear would be the ping of the microwave just before his head exploded. How do we cope with this constant danger? It's simply because danger has always been a prime mover as far as evolution goes. The first primates to venture onto 2 feet almost certainly did so while being pursued by something hungry with a lot of teeth. He just reared up, put his head back, and got those arms pumping. The extra turn of speed ensured his survival, and his ancestors became us. Behind every Olympic sprinter, there is the race memory of a hungry predator snapping at his arse. Stupid sayings. Throughout history, mankind has managed to come up with the most ridiculous sayings that for some bizarre reason are accepted as gospel by the populace, despite the fact that they are palpable nonsense. I saw a fight once. One guy ran up and kicked the other square in the family jewels. The guy standing next to me said, "Ooh, that's not cricket." "Oh, well spotted. No, that's not cricket. That's street fighting, that is. Why do we say these things? There are hundreds of them. Not until the cows come home. Where have they been? Cows don't go anywhere. Cows live in a field all their lives. Then we kill them and eat them." "You're all done up like a dog's dinner." "The saying, you look like a plate of brown gunk with bits of fat and gristle. That's supposed to be some kind of compliment, is it?" "Speak of the devil and he will appear. It's never happened to me. I speak of him often and he's yet to turn up. And let's face it, he'd be hard to miss. Tall red bugger with hooves. Sort of difficult to ignore. Satan, we're speaking of you. Come in, Beelzebub." "Nah, he's not going to appear. He's too busy scheduling afternoon TV." The vinegar stroke. Couldn't we come up with something a tad more poetic for the most sublime moment of human ecstasy? We say these stupid things every day. What are we talking about? Many a mickle makes a muckle. What's that, Martian? When in Rome, do as the Romans do. But I can't speak Italian. Does that mean I can't go there? And if I do, do I have to support Lazio and pinch girls' bums? "Where's me ticket?" "No, I'm sorry. I was thinking out loud." "No, I wasn't. I was talking. Thinking out loud is called talking, and we all talk bollocks. Excuse my mouth. I need it like I need a hole in the head." "Do you have to get off your trolley before you get out your tree? It's all complete nonsense, and we only say it because it's easy, and people just nod and say, 'Yeah, too right,' which doesn't mean anything either.
Charity begins at home. No, no, that's called keeping all your money for yourself and not giving any of it away, which is, in fact, the opposite of charity. I got it straight from the horse's mouth. What? Horse spit? Who comes up with these stupid sayings? How many people do you know who are saving for a rainy day? What kind of umbrella are they thinking of? Call me old-fashioned, but I sent my son up chimneys. Well, it keeps him out of mischief. I went up to a gang of Hell's Angels the other day and said, I want some trouble. I should have known. I should have known I was asking for trouble. The biggest biker said, you want some, son? I said, I'm sorry, but I can't speak Chinese. Still, all's well that ends well. End of side one.